Sir.
Is the junior K program counted in the ADM?
Yes.
It starts in junior K?
Yep.
Okay.
Good question. Because they qualify according to state rules under the age to be in that junior K. Yep. However, preschools do not. Because that was a great question, so I want to go down to, well, other districts have a preschool program. Well, some of it's funded by the district, some of it's not. And people say, well, if you get a preschool program, you can add it into the funding formula and get that. I want to make that very clear, that's not the way the funding formula works, okay? They have to have a student ID, or WISER ID, and they have to have a certain age limit, so there's a lot more to that. Okay,
great question.
Question.
So obviously, number of students is directly connected to funding. Can you just say a few words about how funding breaks down, like where the sources of funding exactly are?
So sources of funding, so like different categories. So special ed is its own pot, okay? And that has, and then you have transportation, different facilities. But as far as educational funding go, when it generates that, our general overall goal is 80% salaries and benefits. So we try to put at least 80% of what we're funded for general ed into salaries and benefits, and then we try to operate on that other 20%. Great question. So we live in the state of Wyoming where we have an equity. So there was a Campbell case, which they won, which there's equity across the board on how schools are funded. So majority of the funding, and just being honest, it's complicated, but I'm going to say majority of the funding comes from your mineral industry. That's where a majority of funding for public education comes from. And then it comes from your local revenue. So some of your property taxes and things of that nature. So the business manager's here and we can do a 2-hour conversation on where that actually goes. But if I were to summarize it, majority comes from the mineral industry and then the rest comes from your local community. What your local community can't provide, the state picks up through the revenue they gain through minerals. That's probably the best way to describe that, because it really is more complicated than that, but mineral industry. So with the mineral industry, the boom and bust always happens, right? So coal mines are shutting down, the mineral industry is changing, so that means local revenues are going to be at a certain amount, and then when the state has to pick up that, when the revenues aren't coming up from the mineral industry, that creates that conversation with legislators about how do we properly fund public education and where are they going to get the money. So it is really a trickle-up effect when you really think about it, depending on what your economy is. Yes, we won't argue the point that the state has put a lot of money away, and they have a huge savings account. I'm not going to get into that politics aspect of it, but the reality is at some point in time, they're going to have to make decisions on how to stabilize educational funding, because the mineral industry is not as stable as it used to be. Okay? Question in the back.
What consequences could result from you guys being underfunded for the wage maintenance on the general operation of this?
What consequences can happen? Pray every day that the school's gonna stay open and HVACs are gonna run. My biggest thing is we have to prioritize educational space. So some of these projects that are outside the educational classroom, your HVAC systems, all those wishes that we wish we had a nice this, we wish we had a nice that, those kind of get pushed and we start focusing on what's it take to keep your building up and operational throughout the day, and then so we can keep the doors open. That's the consequence, is if we don't focus on the educational space and the facilities that keep the rooms open, the rooms heated, ultimately we could not have school and be virtual, or we can move to a different building. I mean, those are all options that are on the table that we don't want to think about. However, I think our approach with the work you've done and everybody else coming back to that, we now show the state that if they want us to maintain the buildings, they got to help us fund them. So that's the work we're doing. That excitement, I know nobody understands this, but the excitement that we even got $4.4 million into a component project pipeline means that we can put another one and another one in so that we can actually use some of our major maintenance. to keep the buildings up and keep them paced. Because our roofs and our HVAC systems cost money, right? Any idea how much it costs to turn the lights on at VHS annually? Over $120,000 just to turn the lights on. Right? That doesn't include the propane and all the other stuff. So just to keep the lights on is $120,000. So as we look at some of those things, maintaining, putting LED lights in, being more efficient, I'm excited. John has our vision since John and I started together, because I got hired and I hired John. John wasn't, he was already hired. I just did do an interview. We went to one platform with a lot of things to be more efficient. So even our door systems, our video systems, were to one platform, and so we're maintaining them more effectively, keeping some of our stuff open. But the reality is, what would happen if there's a point in time where there's no money, the state doesn't have an emergency fund that says, hey, here's $3 million to fix what you need to fix. They're going to say, what do you need to do? Well, you're going to have to come up with the money. So that's unfortunate. Sarah?
When you talk about our district being overstaffed, is it clear where we are overstaffed? Is that coming in the form of certified staff or classified staff, elementary,
so,
or?
To answer that question is, that's why the first time we've established a funding formula so we can start looking at where staffing is and how many staff we have.
So
to clearly say that's where it is, no, but the formula says this is where we, our target, and so you're going to see what that target looks like. I can say for tech, they've already reduced their staff by one. So we got less staff, we got less tech that's doing work with more technology than they had. John's staff is at the bare bones. You need to see the square footage and what we're doing. We actually repurposed their job description so that they're not just grounds and buildings. They're all doing the same job, so we can distribute among what that looks like. Food service, for those of you that don't know, food service is zero funding in the state model. Zero. So the employees, their benefits, and we're struggling getting enough cooks just to make sure we have lunch and breakfast. That classified staff is very minimal with that piece, but we also have to supplement that because we don't make enough revenue from selling lunch, so that's supplemented with the budget. Transportation, you're already seeing, is down, even though it's 100% reimbursable. We're trying to with that piece, but we're already down to 21 compared to 34, 35, a lot of numbers in my head, sorry. But classified staff is pretty minimal. The largest department in the district is special ed. All right, that was it. Those of you that are at the beginning of the year, remember how I divided the departments up? I had schools set up, and then we had special ed come down here. The largest piece of the support we have for our kids in our community with special ed is phenomenal. So paras and different things like that. However, people don't realize we just can't hire 12 paras. The special ed world has a formula that says you can only have so many. Because when it becomes 100% reimbursable, the state's going to say, I'm not going to give you an endless amount of employees. They're going to say, here's the funding, here's what you receive, this is all you can do. So there's even parameters that the special ed department has to fall under. Ask that question in 2 years, and I'll give you more specific information. There?
There was a slide in this section you just came through that looked at the state viewing the school district and coming out with the proportions or percentages for the VHS, and it showed the New West at 111%. Could you go back and clarify what the state is seeing when they look at ADM?
So that will be very clear. It's square footage and ADM that creates a formula. So the number of students according to the square footage tells you what the educational space will be. So that's how the state comes up with that.
And then does the state look at that and say you have too much facilities? So
great question. So if you go back to that slide, what do you think the state is looking at when they say the number of square footage that we have? The state is saying, are you being effective? So here's what the state will do. The state's never going to come and say, Charles, you need to go to your board of trustees and you need to close down the school because your square footage doesn't match that. What the state's going to come in and say is, look, we're giving you this amount of money based on ADM to keep your school up and running. At a certain point in time, school districts then have to make the decision. I don't have enough money to run the facilities because we don't have kids, so then what do we use to utilize those buildings? I can sit here and argue these numbers all day long, because if we were to increase some of our class sizes, let's just go to Menlark Elementary, if we were to double or add another 200 or 300 kids, kids would be standing on top of each other with that percentage. So we do have an obligation to support and argue those points. But if you are correct in saying, the state's coming back saying, hey, look at our formula that says you're here, you need to defend it, and at a certain point in time, a discussion might have to be had in saying, where is your square footage and why aren't you combining schools?
And following up on that, then looking at the U.S., because there has been conversations in prior months about New West gaining its own standalone building to support, so they don't have the 100%. Is that feasible, or is it folded back into the high school?
So those are things that we have on the conversation table.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I guess the overall point is I want you to understand, not to say, because you're asking good questions. I want you to understand that these are all the factors we look at, all right? And so there's a committee that gets put together. This is what the board's coming in. You can ask any board member. They didn't drink from a garden hose when we started in public education under Charles. They've been probably drinking from a fire hose ever since they started, all right? And looking at all the factors. If it was simple, this is only the tip of the iceberg on what we have to take into consideration. But the question you're asking, I hope you answered, we are looking at all of this stuff when we have to make a decision.
So the state doesn't look at VHS and say, well, there needs to be some drastic changes here.
The state's going to tell me as a superintendent, you only get so much money to heat and do that building, and you have to decide as a district how you distribute that money, if it's keeping a building open or are putting combination or what that grade, and then we'd have to do a study to make sure it's appropriate in educational space. So yeah, these are numbers that we have a conversation. And I'm not going to put John on the spot, but those are conversations that John and I have to have with the Board of Trustees when we do our state facility plans, all right? So the state doesn't come up with these numbers just to show them. These are conversations that we have to have. Good questions.
Mr. Oski, how do you see going from 28 to 24 credits helping you with all of this?
So, a great question. The question is giving me the flexibility not to have to say, we have to provide 28 credits for kids. It's being able to have the flexibility. Because we've already started to reduce. But now the question is starting to say, we can't do this because it requires this, because it requires that. So that flexibility with policy, and it's a minimum. It doesn't mean that that's where we're going to stay. But we have to start having that conversation. The policy drives everything we do. And when you develop policy, and when you start looking way at what other school districts are doing and where they're at, that doesn't mean they're limited. As a matter of fact, they're doing quite well in some cases. We're doing better in some areas than they are, but overall, they're doing well. But if we're also going to look at public education, and we're competing with entities that require 20 credits for graduation. I'm going to speak for myself. When I was in high school, if you had said this sheet of paper gets you the same opportunities for 20 credits on a virtual school, and you can still do some of these things and go on to college, it's a different ball game with kids now. It really is. So when we say at-risk kids are involved in activities, well, it comes back to at-risk kids also being eligible in it. There's just so many different conversations. But what I'm saying here, that doesn't mean we are limited to not providing opportunities if we have the resources to do it. It just gives us more flexibility on how we have to look at things. All right? And if we continue the work we're doing, which we will, with the profile of the graduate, what the governor's doing, and what we're doing with the Whitney Foundation, if any of you know Whitney, they don't fund something unless they're going to stick it out. All right? To change how we get kids into career and support industry in our local region. I mean, those are things that I think as we look, I mean, what they're looking at, there are state policies that have to change. They're looking at being at the table. They're looking at being a recalibration in the summer, which is every 5 years, which again, maybe too much information for everybody here. But start having that question. Why can't we change the way we look at public education and how you fund it instead of tying it to seat time? Because in reality, a lot of it comes down to seat time, all right? How we control things. So we've got some dogs in the fight, all right? I'll use the word dogs. Mean dogs in the fight, smart dogs in the fight, however you want to do it. But we are looking more than just year to year. We are looking out in the next 2 to 3 years.
You said early graduation was one of the reasons your numbers were down. Now,
no.
If you lower your number to 24, won't you have more early graduation?
No, because it's the number of credit opportunities. That's a great question. And so we can talk about that. It's still the number of credits you offer within that year. So early graduation is about kids graduating under the parameters. So as you see it staged down a year at a time with the number of credits that you offer. Okay, we're not going to reduce credits and then keep offering 8 credits, because you're correct. We're reducing the number of credits that we can offer. Doesn't mean that we can't offer for college-bound students, concurrent dual enrollment, some of those things. But we already got a lot of kids early graduating. But in the process, is we do have to look at our early graduation policy.
And this might be coming up here in just a moment, but are you going to be showing us the revenue, the cost, and the deficit? You know, kind of help us understand that magnitude and some of the line items.
So I don't have that line item, so we can come back and talk about where that revenue is. But the simple piece is 80% of our budget is where we try to land with the revenue that comes in. So in where that deficit is and where you're looking at is right now, we're at about 80%. So if we're going to increase our salaries, which is a cost to salaries and benefits, the money comes within the number of employees, all right? So there's just a certain pot. So we can show you that overall piece, but that is not a slide that we have here, because then most everybody would be ready to go. That's something, if you want to reach out to Connie, we can sit down and have that conversation. That kind of shows up in our monthly board reports where funding is going. But we can have some of those conversations, okay?
Certainly.
Now, I'm not trying to dodge it. I'd love to have it, but there needs to be some time with that, okay? Whoever.
Yeah. I'm wondering what kind of conversations you've been having with the leaders in the community to get people to come to our community and stay in the community. Because if people are leaving, obviously the population and kids are not staying in the community.
So having a conversation with community leaders. This is a conversation that community leaders are already having about our community. Where's the housing? I mean, where we have our industry, and that's part of why the gentleman I talked with about where the stats are, is they're coming back to the table, is how do we bring industry in, what are we doing to bring families back, how do we have that conversation, because I have been having that conversation, same as the hospital and everywhere else. We sometimes are not getting teachers because they can't find a house or they can't afford a house. So having that conversation with those leaders is already happening. To the extent of we need some type of ability within our communities to recruit the people to come into. So overall, they have their things that they're working on, but to have that conversation that we're struggling with recruiting because we can't get housing, and that younger generation is something that I think the county and the city are both looking at. Is when we have to reduce staff based on ADM, okay, we got to have policy that allows us to do it. because the rest of it, the cost for facilities and maintenance and operation isn't going down. So when we look at that, we also have to look at efficiencies. And I get it, it's scary. I don't want to paint the roof as fawn. We're going to keep the doors open and we're moving forward. But I sometimes think everybody in the community thinks that's an easy decision, because we do have to prioritize. And that prioritization is we want to keep salaries and benefits at least 80%, if not a little greater. Some districts are 78, some are 83%. But falling within that realm, knowing that number of students coming in, this is the pot of money we get for staff salaries and benefits. How do I distribute that among all the schools and all the teachers so we can keep the proper staff? That's probably the easiest way to summarize that, is changing from one credit to another. Because if we require 28 credits or 32 opportunities, that means that I don't have a lot of flexibility in going to the principals and saying, look, the way the funding works right now, you have 12 staff, and they'll come back and say, well, I can't, because board policy requires that we have to offer so many opportunities. And then when we do that, then where do I steal from? Do I already steal from facilities to do that? Do I steal from somewhere else to do that? So looking at projections and flexibility, if we have an increase in ADM and our graduation credits stay at 24, doesn't mean we still can't provide some other opportunities for kids. It's just when we have a policy that dictates that we can't be flexible with the changing environment, those are more real hard conversations, all right? And the policy says, and graduation, and I'm just using examples, I don't want elementary versus high school. We come in and we say we have to offer so many kids at the high school, and our elementary classes have to go up to 1 to 22, stay within that 80% budget, that's impacting them. So it kind of has to be a balance and share. And again, I know it's not easy to understand, but what we're trying to do is at least allow flexibility so that we can make decisions based on what our projected ADM is. Okay, and it might be easier if I sit down or Connie sits down and helps discuss that a little bit better. Because it's not easy. Question? Did you have your hand?
Okay. So, sorry, I'm Tracy Gerwin. I'm wrapping my mind around all of the finances, right? We recognize this is an issue. I'm with you that it is tough to see the correlation, and it's kind of been explained to us a couple of different ways. But tonight you were presenting that one of the positives of going to 24 for 28 was to look more attractive to students, right? Trying to bring some of those students back and help the ADM. We want to compete with other schools. And so I guess my biggest question stems from my firm and foundational belief that any major change in a policy that's going to change the culture of a school district should have input from all around, right, from all stakeholders. So I'm wondering, what are we doing, like what is the administration doing to actually like elicit that input from parents to find out, does this change actually make you more likely to want to stay with the district or not? Like, have we surveyed, and what is our plan to try to garner the feedback from parents who arguably are the most important stakeholders in any school district? So that's my big question.
Part of what I'm doing tonight is to explain why we're doing what we're doing. Because again, a survey that goes out when you don't understand all the complications behind the decision we're making isn't really good data either. But at some point in time, the community and the board's gonna have to trust the superintendent that we've done our due diligence to make sure what we're recommending to the board is not impacted. Because I don't disagree with you, it's gonna impact culture. But I've also got to balance the fact is, what's gonna be more impactful when I say, you have to cut 15% of your staff in every building. And not having this conversation and being proactive over a period of time. So balancing, you know, and we've been to a couple meetings, let's pick your own poison of what you want to do. But again, surveying but not understanding the complications behind of what the recommendation is. But I also want to point out, This isn't something that happened in the last 2 months. This is something through the board directive that we've looked at what consistently high-performing districts and their cultures are good, right? And as a matter of fact, you can go back to Pinedale and look at those statistics. When you look it up, they went from an 8-period schedule to a 7-period schedule, and they're thriving. So again, how the communities and how the schools reacted to what that looks like are some things that, again, we're in control of our destiny and that input. But I guess to summarize it, what I'm trying to express to you and to the community, this didn't happen just by dreaming over the middle night. This is a process that's taken place for a couple of years. Okay? And we went and visited schools. We just didn't look at the data. We actually went and visited the school and asked a lot of hard questions.
Mr. Elsie, my question first, I have two, but right now, is this a plan that is already happening? We are going down to the credit reduction that's already...
So this is a recommendation I have to the board that will be voted on. We've already done the efficiencies that were talked about. We've already tried to reduce where we can. And now what we're seeing is some of the limitations on what we can and can't do. So again, the board can choose not to accept my recommendation, and then I'll go back to the drawing table, and we can look at different avenues of how we do that. And that's the board's decision. My job as a superintendent is to follow and do expectations. So going out and looking and being productive with actual real Wyoming school districts that are consistently showing that they're doing well was the task that was at hand, and these are some of the areas that we looked at that we are different. And there are some things we do quite well or even better than them. But again, policy is going to restrict what we can do as a board in some of these cases, and just giving some flexibility to make some decisions is kind of what we're trying to say. Okay.
Do you have a slide that explains reducing the periods during the day is going to reduce? Do you have anything that explains?
Reducing periods, a slide that shows what?
Right. What are you going to say by reducing the amount of periods? What is that?
Okay, so when we go back to reducing credits, it's the graduation credits, all right? So staffing drives what we can provide because teachers have to be certain certified. One teacher, just because you have a certification, can't teach multiple areas. There's exceptions to that in different areas. But the number of teachers that you have to supply according to the number of required graduation credits really does drive the number of teachers per building. So with that, the slide that looks like, so we can go and I'll put it up on the website, but again, these 32 credits reduced to 24 is the minimum. Doesn't mean it can exceed, it can always go higher than that. But right now, if you're saying that we want to provide 32 opportunities for kids, that means we have to have a number of certified staff that meet those expectations. And when you do that, that limits your flexibility. That means that's where you're going to be stuck with staff. The high school graduation requirements are the only ones that really determine that. Because the elementary, you just increase class sizes. So I can just, you know, if there's no graduation requirements, you just say, hey, this is where you're at. This is what you're going to fund. Changing policy gives us a little bit more flexibility if we have to make those hard decisions, which if the numbers allow you to really adjust your staff to what, first of all, focusing on what do we add, I mean, narrowing our focus to what do we want our kids to have experiences in and staying within that. So an actual slide that shows where that at is the funding formula. I'll put the initiative back on the website. You can see the staffing initiative of kind of that tentative template of how we project or projecting what we can allow for each building to stay within our funding needs.
I just want some explanation on so you're trying to limit staff. So if you take out a period during the day, you have not a shorter day, but you have less classes you have to take. So is it essentially, because you're required to take so many core credits, essentially the electives are going to get cut because students are only going to have so many periods in the day to take all the required credits, so then they're not going to have the opportunity to take the electives because we've taken time away from them.
Yeah, and that's good. But in that process, 13 credits are what required core, 19 is what's required for Hathaway. So even in that process of 28 credits, which will provide that opportunity, Hathaway is part of that. There's still multiple opportunities for kids to take elective classes. So not as many as there is on a 28 period day or 32 options. So yes, it comes back to kids are going to have to make some choices. So is the school district. The school district's going to have to choose how do we fund, okay, and how do we stay within our means. That's what the hard conversation is coming down to.
Question for you. You said that you've been working on this for a couple of years, and this is your recommendation coming out of that process. So I would think that you've thought about other different options, other strategies you can take to make the finances work. What are the other options that you consider, and why are those less optimal than what it is you're...
Okay, so we've already done some of those things. So taking a look at reduction of tech staff, where we're at with some of these other classified staff, I pushed all of our grant funds in special ed to another place or move people into that special funding. So we've been doing this for a while. So other options are, it comes back to that choice of, again, having that focus of 80-20. If we want to be more than 80% of our budgets and salaries and benefits to provide staff for what we want our kids to have experiences are, then that comes out of facilities, keeping the lights on. So those are the options. So where are we looking at efficiencies? We're looking at efficiencies in all areas. Right, but the cost of keeping lights on, the cost of doing business and some of those things is kind of where you have to look. But in addition to that, we're also seeking other federal grants. So how can we apply grants? How can we take a position and apply it there? So in some cases, some of the teaching positions have moved to different grant options or different funding avenues. But then when you talk about a grant, I've got to be honest, a grant comes to an end, that means that position ends. So looking at those different options is really that focus of answering your question is, if we were 75% of our budget on salaries and benefits, it would be a discussion saying, hey, we have 5 to 6% more that we in operations that we need to take a look at cutting to find that. We've kind of already tried to do that over the last couple of years. So when we say coming back to that optimum thing is, if we're gonna stay at that 80 to 82%, whatever we want to land as a district, of salaries and benefits, that means that's the pot of money, and that's the number of teachers we're going to fund. And then how do I distribute that among the entire K-12 district is where the challenge will come in as from our position. So, again, the answer of what other options I've looked at, the options that I've looked at is looking at our budget and saying, look, general operations operates on 20%. Now it's taking a look at what are limitations to actually take that 80 to 82% for salaries and benefits, because that's where some of the effectiveness comes in.
Approach it from a different angle, please, Mr. Super. What if we do nothing? What if we leave everything stand pat and the projected enrollment occurs anyway? What will be the outcome?
So there's a couple things. We're going to have an ECA this year, so we're going to have a cushion. Everybody's going to feel good about it. And then the next year, after the lawsuit's over and they don't put the ECA in, we're going to come back and say we are contracted employees, which are tenured employees, are going to have, we have to hire this many people, all right? And we'll probably have to look at a RIF policy if we want to stay at the current salary, or we have to look at reducing our base, or we have to say where are we going to get that extra 2 to 3% out of our operations? Are we going to have to combine schools? Those are conversations that would probably be real. I don't want to go there. That's Z on the alphabet. We got A, B, C, and D. But again, this is not me wanting to take away opportunities from your kids. This is about me saying, as a district, if we don't have some flexibility on how our ADM and PACs are funding, and we're not allowed to make good decisions, then some real hard decisions will have to be made.
Thank you.
Yes, so for the districts that have already done this, right, because that's kind of what you're showing, is there's districts that have done reductions. Do you have any data on, like, what the percentage of staff reduction was as well as salary increase, right? Because that's kind of what you're trying to do here is increase the salary to be more...
So if you go back to that salary piece, you'll see that they're very competitive, way above us as far as competitive. So several years ago when the sky was falling and they told every district they were going to cut 10%, those districts made that cut and didn't hire people back. We did not. Okay? So prior to that COVID, when the world was falling and the sky was falling and everybody, the governor and everybody said you're going to cut 10%, districts that made those cuts and didn't bring people back are the ones that are kind of ahead of the game with us. That's the simplest way to say it. So in that process, it's kind of a catch-up game with where we're at. But again, it really comes down to class size. It comes down to that. Are they the 80 to 82% of salaries and benefits? What are they doing to manage the utilities and just the general operations, which all that kind of falls into. But again, you will see that, we could take these names off and we just look at high performing. This is an economy of scale. They only have 599 kids, all right, in a district. And they're at a base of 50,000. Let me tell you the summary of that. They're not offering the things we offer. You'll hear people say very clearly, they're not offering the things we offer because they had to limit, they had to reduce what their kids had access to in order to get that base salary up. All right? So you do an economy of scale and you do some different things. Powell High School is at 1,800. We're here. They're almost 700 students more than. Yeah, we can balance that out. But when you look at that piece, still their class sizes are on a 7-period day. But most of these districts, when the sky was falling, I think probably back in 2019 across the state, a lot of districts made the hard cut and then they increased their base and they kind of maintained that throughout. However, I do want to make this point. The sustainability of some districts, because they probably use ESSER funds to always bump that, we're probably not seeing the behind-the-scenes talks that are happening. Okay, we supplemented this base salary with ESSER funds. ESSER funds are gone. So they're probably having some real hard conversations now, too. Sarah?
In the discussion of a 7-period day, will the option of providing credit opportunities with all of the activities and athletics that we do provide for kids be an option to make up some of those credits? For example, a kid that is out for sports, not needing to take as many PE credits because they receive credit for being out for those activities and participating and being part of the program and meeting the requirements, would open up an extra class period for them during the day to take a music class because they want to do both of those. Will that be because we offer...
So those are discussions that are on the table if we decide to move to that with what we're actually requiring. So a PE credits is one of them. However, with that idea that's been thrown out multiple times about kids in the activities getting a credit for it, again, a credit has to be tied to standards and how do you evaluate that? There's some things that we have to look at on that. If we're offering a credit towards graduation, there are standards that have to be met, so we do have to make sure those are addressed. So those are questions that have been asked.
With the 7 periods in the day, would that be the same amount of time? Would the class length be longer, or would it still be?
So you can divide the day up any way you want. So part of the expectations is being a PLC district. You know, that's our focus has been professional learning communities. Where are we headed with that? Is a collaboration time where teachers can actually be looking at students' data. And if kids are falling behind, we catch them early rather than late. So we're also looking at why do we have summer school and we're trying to catch kids early, trying to catch them up in the summer when we can catch them so we're not doing credit recovery. So it's bringing a lot of those pieces back. But as an example, just because it's 7 doesn't mean it has to be a 7-period day. It could be an 8-period day with 1 period in there for enrichment, electives. It could be... a class that's not offered for credit where kids get caught up with their homework so they don't have homework at home. And you can divide the day up any way you want with that. There's one district that offers 50 credits. 50. There are seven periods, there are 24, 25 graduation credits. They offer 50 credits because they offer a credit for every semester of a class, and then they divide it in two. So again, schools will have the flexibility to draft up a schedule to meet the needs of the kids, and that could look different than a seven-period day. It could be an eight-period day. It could be a nine-period day, but there's only seven credit opportunities within that because you're doing enrichment, you're doing catching those at-risk kids. You know, we talked about Sarah, who said, what are you doing for those kids that are trying to stay eligible? Some of those type of enrichment or activities that catch kids, get them in a position so they're within a teacher, within that schedule. So you can be creative with what that looks like. And again, that comes back to building leadership and teams determining what that master schedule will look like. There's another middle school. They have 10 periods. All right, 10 periods. All right, they still offer electives, but two periods are core. So math, science, and English are actually two of the 10. So there's a total of six, and there's four others. But the perception from the community is, wow, they offer 10, their schedule is 10 classes. Okay, but some of those are doubled up. So again, it can be confusing, but your master's schedule can be developed in such a way, it doesn't just necessarily say it's a seven-period day. Those are just a number of credits. It can be an eight-period day, it can be a nine-period day, and you divide that up. So how they slice the time up is what I'm hoping the teams and building leadership will also say, this is what our kids need, this is how our staff is, this is the expertise of our staff, how do we apply that?
Did any of the other schools lose completely lose a program?
So I'm going to be transparent. The programs are based on people. And I'm not going to say that they didn't lose programs because, like, when you look at Powell, they've been at this for over 12 to 13 years. So I'm not going to be able to go back and say, hey, what did you lose when you were at this schedule? We've been on this schedule for 27 years. And somebody helped me clarify that today. Okay, 27 years, education has changed. So where are we at? What does that look like? So me to sit here and say, oh gosh, no, we're not going to, there's not going to be a program that goes away or there's not going to be a reduction in staff. I'm simply saying it's either a process of attrition. We have a program that only has two or three kids in it. What does that look like? Doesn't mean we won't support it, but we might not fund it at the same level that we're funding it, all right? So we will have to look at programs. But if you got a program that's bigger than another program, you know, that comes back to leadership and talking about what that looks like. But for me to sit here and say, hey, nothing's going to happen, we're not going to have to cut anything, that would be me lying to you. Because the reality is, when we start looking at efficiencies, that means there's going to be certain things that we're going to have to make choices about. Okay, and kids will have to make choices and kind of work. That's kind of the crossroads we're at. So it's a weighted GPA, which is part of where they're at, and that's a choice in the track they're on, being competitive. Okay, what it will come down to is, okay, they choose a concurrent dual enrollment over maybe an elective class that's not a concurrent dual enrollment, and for me to say that's not going to happen, kids will have to make choices on if that competitive, because that's absolutely right, that's on the table of what that looks like. However, 8 credits, not every kid is in that plate being competitive to be in 8 classes and keeping their grades up too. I mean, that's the other side of the story that probably not a lot of people will hear, but I've heard, all right, that kids are exhausted, they have to keep up. So there's different tracks that every kid is on. But reality is kids will probably have to make some choices about what track they want to stay on, but it's never going to take away that opportunity. If a kid wants to be college bound and keep their GPA up, we are going to try to do everything we can to make sure we have those options. But having two or three different options or tracks to be on, reality is, how do we fund that? That's what it comes down to. Simply is, how do we fund a whole bunch of different tracks? That's the question that I have to answer.
I'm just wondering, because this does seem like it would be a clear effect, because they're already using their electives for this purpose, and if they're having one less, if there's not another option, is there some way to mitigate it? Is there some way for some kids to take it classes?
So I want to come back to the answer is, if you have kids and the building leadership comes to me and says, you have 12 kids that want to take a 0 hour, how do we fund it? Then that comes to the table and we talk about what that concurrent enrollment looks like, okay? But to fund one teacher for three kids that want to make maybe go above and beyond, it's a numbers game, it really is. But it also doesn't keep from you as families, if you want kids taking extra courses, you know, you can register, you can do the work with the counselor. We've already kind of went through that process of what that looks like. So there's different avenues that you can do. So us coming to you and saying, you will never get an opportunity, that's never going to come out of my communication. However, there's still limits to what we can offer and can't offer. Because even those free credits, there's no such thing as free. I mean, let's come back to it. Free college education. You as taxpayers are paying for it, your college is paying for it, so you have 20 credits, anything above and beyond that. I mean, Michelle, she's here, she's super smart about that, so I'm not even talk about that, so that's in her realm. But we also learned by visiting schools that they're doing things a little bit different. So kind of tightening up that process. But the reality is, if you have a group of 20 kids, but I have 60 that are on another track, we have to take a look at that and have that flexibility of what it looks like. Okay, but please hear me. I am not going to sit here as a superintendent and pull wool over your eyes and say, oh, nothing's going to be impacted. There will be choices, hard choices, that kids and families have to make. Not on, you can't do this anymore, but maybe on multiple tracks that we would have been able to provide before. But if our numbers go up, all right, doesn't mean that we can't still look at doing different tracks, all right? It's just, what can we provide under the realm of where we're at with staff.
I just have a question about the AP classes. So our daughter is on track to be, she's doing well. So if that eighth period or seventh period, whatever that is there still going to be time allowed for her to do AP classes? Even if we have to pay for them ourselves, would there be time during the day?
So again, that's going to come back to building leadership and counselors, what the schedule looks like, and it is according to the staff and who can teach the class.
And then are you going to have days? Do you have samples out of what a day would look like for a seventh-period day?
So if the board approves this, then the teams and the buildings are going to have to go to work with what their schedules look like, and obviously they always bring it back to, is what are the needs of the kids and how do we meet those individual needs? Okay, so for me to present that to you today is, I'm presenting, as a superintendent, number of graduation credits.
But do you have, samples of, Powell schedules or somebody else's schedule that is on that schedule and what that is?
So those schedules were in front of the teams, so yes, those are schedules there, if you want to look at that.
Yeah.
But again, the master schedule developed through building leadership, through what we are requiring, and those are all the things that you take into consideration.
But are those open to the public?
So you can go to the website, or I can get you a GIF, or I can give you what some of those schedules look like, and you can take a look at those.
What they look like. So as you make this recommendation for credit reduction, isn't part of your recommendation to the board include what your recommendations or what programs are going to be cut, or should be being cut, and how that's going to impact?
So my recommendation to the board is our graduation credits change, so then we look at policy that's impacted with graduation requirements. Then that comes back to, again, those efficiencies that we lined up. What programs what are the efficiencies that we need to look at and what that looks like? It is not my job or the job of the Board of Trustees to come to either building leadership and say, you can cut this program, especially if that program has 60 kids in it and you have another program that has three. It looks a little different, and it's going to have to come back to the needs of the district, not the needs of the district, the needs of the kids within those schools. So again, that's something with building leadership. If we approve this, if it gets approved, all right, we'll come back to building leadership, working with the teams and the students' needs to determine what we can and can't offer as we transition from 28 credits to 24 credits over the next 4 years.
Would you address the timeline that was presented so that everybody knows?
So again, if this is approved, the work then begins in changing policy. Then after policy changes, they'll already start with master schedule, and then the credit reduction is one credit a year until 2029. All right? And I know it's fearful, and I know it's out there that kids are not going to be able to be effective, but I do have to come back and say, I have to be able to say we have to live within our means, and we did base it on other districts that have high-performing and successful cultures and communities, all right? And the research behind some of that. So, transparency, there are some programs that probably won't be, we won't have that others, or we can make a choice to keep this program over another, but to keep the same level of smorgasbord for the same cost of money or reduction in money means that we need to start having a hard look at where we're at. Yes.
Sorry, one more question.
No.
So, you know, obviously this change would reduce the competitiveness of the school relative to other options. You know, what can we be doing to offset that so that we don't have that downward spiral where ADM continues to decrease as we're, as the quality of the education or the environment or however you want to describe it is going?
So the first thing we've already done is we've done a communication audit, okay? How do we start selling ourselves as the best option for parents and community members, brick and mortar? I mean, that's the number one thing we need to do. We want our kids and our community to say, we want our kids within the brick and mortar because that's what it impacts. So it starts with us communicating that. That's why we're looking at what does that avenue look like and sell that piece. So that does start there. But I'm also going to bring back into that fact is, if you look at trends, okay, homeschool, private schools, and charter schools are trending in a way that we're probably not going to get 100% of our kids back in school. But when we start looking at that is we also have to look at the trend of, okay, how do we start stabilizing? If you look at that trend, we are, if you go back to 2000, when you looked at the, was it 2005, when we were 1,100 kids, about kind of in that same neighborhood. What you're seeing is, if you look at it statistically, which I know some of you know that, is we had a bubble. And now the bubble's coming back to where kind of where we're sustaining. And the other thing I don't control is the amount of young families and how many kids young families are having or moving into the community. That's a non-controllable. I can't go out to families and say, you need to have some more kids. Even though I know a couple in the room that probably could have more kids, they'd be excited about it. That would be all something that's good. But we can't do that. So, statistics show that young families are one or two. We live in a ranching community where four or five kids used to be kind of the common theme for family sizes. That's no longer something I can say is common in Johnson County. Aging population. So, that aging population is about, how do we get industry in and recruit people and families to come here and work? That's, I think, a question that happened in the back. What are we doing with local leadership to bring in businesses and to bring in the opportunity for people to live? That's a challenge that we can come to the table with. The school districts also can't throw money at it because public funds have certain requirements that we have to stay within when we do that. But I guess my overall picture for you is, what do we need to do? We need to sell our product as the best, okay? Realize that part of what the communication plan was to come back is out of the 155 students, I guess my goal was 50% of them to get back in school. knowing that we set a realistic goal? Can we get kids back in school? Can we communicate? And more importantly, can we show what we're doing is beneficial for kids and good for kids? That's the answer that I attempted to do through the board with the communication plan. How do we sell our district as the best school option for community members in Johnson County?
So has that happened like in Sheridan? Sheridan County, where they've gone to a reduced number of hours, have they seen at least a percentage of students go the other way that are not in the public schools? But
so in their economy and where they're at, they're staying pretty steady with student enrollment. They're staying pretty steady with the influx of population and industry. So when you look at that, Sheridan County is one that looks like they're kind of stabilized. However, just across down the neighborhood, Natrona is down. They were down 300 plus students compared to what they were predicting coming in. So some of that is the community, the environment, and what they're doing. So state of Wyoming. So when I started as a superintendent in 2013, they had about 92,000 students in the state of Wyoming. The last report that came out, we have about 89,600. So even statewide, we're seeing a number of students decline around the state. Some communities are growing. Powell would be one of them. That's why they added staff, because they've seen it population growth, not student growth, not necessarily population growth. But some districts are in the boat where they're reduction. Natrona closed schools down, pushed teachers to another building. That was their option. Gillette, I think, is steady for now, but they're having that conversation. But when you talk about Sheridan, their economy has been pretty stable for quite a while.
Do you think going to the reduced number of credits required, right? Are they seeing a benefit from that in regard to their percentage of enrollment in public schools versus the other alternatives?
I think it comes back to, are they seeing a benefit to that? Yeah, they're high performing. That's what they're at least considered high performing all the time. So they do have probably a higher percentage of kids that are in the system that are not in the system.
I just make a comment, a point of clarification, and help each other with the number. But every school has to go the same amount of hours. Is how it needs to have a pack. So every high school has to go 1,080 hours a year. And so, because we're offering 28, but I mean our students are doing more, it's just how we unpack 1,000 hours. And so other schools have chosen to do a 7th grade day. We do an 8th grade day. We're all doing the same amount of time. Is how we break down our classes.
And that's a good point. So whether you're a 5-day week, a 4-day week, a 4.5-day week, 3-day week, 2-day week, whatever you decide to do, you have to have 1,000 contact hours for high school, and that's less for middle school and elementary.
I'm back to the doom and gloom a little bit. So we understand that we do have to reduce staff over the next 3 or 4 years. Like, it has to happen. However we choose to do that, however our district decides to do that, in order to get along the funding model and to meet the needs of the agency. I think Mr. Sullivan would like pose a really good question earlier. He asked about other avenues of reaching that. And I guess my question is really about retirement. I know we heard about how, like, the ADM is projected for students. Do we have some sort of a projection based on averages, based on years, on like how many retirements out of the district you might have over the next 3 to 4 years? Is there an avenue we can look at?
So we have 20% of our staff right now that's over 20 years in education. So that's predicting that in a few more years we're going to see early retirement. And I know those are good questions, and I'm trying to answer it in such a way as how do we predict where those efficiencies come from? That comes back to the overall model is we can choose to do 85-15%. I can choose to do 85% of our salaries and benefits go to staff and employees. But when I choose that means operations, which includes food service, facilities, that includes all the one-to-one technology, all of those components, which I think are already very tight, because we've already reduced tech staff, we've already went from multiple devices for teachers to a Chromebook, and we're starting to look at that, what that funding looks like and how we fund that, that's where that component comes out of too. That also then opens that door of his conversation or somebody else's conversation. Can we move two schools into one building and become more efficient with the heating and the lighting, and what does that look like? But when you start pushing schools together, you still have to have the same conversation. You can't, there's only so many rooms in the school, so class sizes go up, number of staff goes down. So again, there's always a trickle effect. So what other options are there? We can sit and have a long conversation. I can sit down and talk, and I'd love to invite him in, and we can sit down and have a conversation with Connie about whether the options that are on the table. But it's going to go well beyond what we're trying to understand here tonight. It's trying to paint a picture of, if our goal is 80%, or the board comes to me and says, Charles, you're going to spend 85% of our budget on salaries and benefits, and you're going to give raises. The state doesn't say, I'm going to give you another 5% for salaries and benefits. They're going to say, take it out of your operations, and what does that look like? That's kind of the general formula of what it looks like. Insurance goes up by 6 to 15%. We get zero extra funding from the state, so we have to take that into consideration. The other part, when we look at depreciation reserve, yeah, I'm putting money away from depreciation reserve, but if we have one student who goes special ed and we have to place them in out of district, that's a quarter to a half a million dollars. The state doesn't reimburse us until the following year. So we also have some reserve, because we know in the environment that we're in that there's always that potential of placing a kid. So we do have to have some funds that we can make good decisions on, because by federal law, I can't restrict a kid from going to a placement because we don't have the funds to do it. As a matter of fact, federal law says if the IEP team comes together and you have a kid that has to be placed in an institution, which I'm just pointing out, not saying we're there, I then have to go back to the general budget. I have no choice but to eliminate staff. And that starts with classified. That starts with pulling funds out of areas that we don't have, because federal law will require that we pay for it. Because the state has already had the lawsuit. They're not paying for it until the next year. So those are financial pieces. When we look at efficiencies, you can come to our budget and say, hey, what's this $350,400 you're putting away for depreciation reserve? Well, I don't put it in depreciation reserve until June 30th, because I don't know what's going to happen with certain things that are out of our control. And again, that's how complicated it can be. I'm trying to keep it at a level if we want to come in and have individual conversations. But again, I guess the one thing that I just want to kind of point out, this is a decision that we're just doing a knee-jerk reaction. We've done a study. I'm trying to give us flexibility as a board, and we can choose not to do it. But I can also come back and say, I love what the facts that are presented to you today show that what we're doing or where our ADM is different. But in the meantime, the funding model hasn't changed, nor do I see it changing. All right? How we save and predict and put funds away for the unexpected expenses, because if anybody's heard of Murphy's Law basically says that unpredictable happens. Mr. Zink, our facilities director, will tell you that when he comes in with unplanned events like boilers or $200,000 in projects just pop up that weren't on the plan. So we do have to financially at some point in time have a little bit of cushion, because for those unpredicted pieces. But I'm not opposed to going to the board and saying, hey, where do you want our salaries and benefits to be? But you have to remember, when we come to that table and we go outside what typical districts are doing, and low-functioning and high-functioning districts are doing, staying within that mark of 78 to 82%, kind of where we fall in that mark, is for salaries and benefits, we can reduce benefits. And we can increase salaries. Some districts have done that. I don't think that's a recruiting tool. You know, employees pay more for their insurance. I mean, there's some other avenues that we can look at, but also got to look at the employee and say, hey, do you want family insurance to be $1,000 a month for family insurance? Because I'll tell you what, a classified employee who's working at $16 to $19 an hour is not going to be able to afford family insurance at $1,000 a month. All right? So we also have to remember, whatever we create has to support not only certified but classified staff when we bring something to the table. So those are some options that are on the table, but for me, that's also non-negotiable for our classified staff, is to increase the cost to the employee with benefits. Because our classified staff is just as important as our certified staff in making sure that we come up. Okay? Anyway, a lot of people are starting to leave. I'd love to sit around and have conversations with any of you individually. There were a couple more slides, but I don't think they're kind of relevant to where we're at tonight. So I will stick around to try to answer any individual questions, as we do have a couple board members here tonight. Okay?
Just one quick question. When will this be voted on?
So it'll be the November board meeting. We're going to work at the work session, which is that first week in July, or not July, November.
November.
And then voted on at the regular board meeting in November. So.
And when do the new board members start? Are the new board
members? They take into their responsibilities at the December meeting.
Okay.
When is the November meeting?
Workers' schedule.
Okay. The 11th?
The 11th is a Monday.
The work session
is the Wednesday before that.
5:15, 6.
Just for clarification, the gist of what you're pursuing here is financially addressing the future based on the ABM, but the constraints of what the board has set up for the qualifications or the parameters that you have to operate in don't give you the flexibility. And so what you're positioning is give flexibility to...
So what I'm positioning, you're absolutely right, so thank you for saying it. I am just asking to create policy that allows flexibility for us to make decisions without having to make major changes year to year based on what our need is.
And right now, the board position doesn't allow flexibility because it's a set parameter that you're operating.
When you talk about graduation credits, you're absolutely right. There are parameters, and we can sit here and argue that all night long, but when you offer a smorgasbord this big, that means I have to have certified staff that offer that many opportunities, and that limits us to what we can do.
And you're asking for flexibility.
I'm asking for flexibility. So again, I'm going to stick around, ask individual questions or answer them, and we'll go from there. I want to thank everybody for coming. So thanks.
This audio was brought to you by State Farm agent Alicia Kozacek, your location agent and good neighbor. This is 307 Net Info. Connecting community.